Hello. Later, what could be good news in the future for what's been one of the hardest forms of eye disease to treat?
It's proof of concept that you can come up with an implant that allows people who are blind to read again. I think it will only get better in time to come.
But meanwhile, back to the present, where internal problems at the Macular Society, which we've been reporting on, are still proving equally hard to treat. Regular listeners will know that proposed changes involving cutting the numbers of the Society's regional managers, who organise the local groups providing advice and support, hasn't been universally well received. In a moment, we'll be hearing again from CEO Ed Holloway about why these changes have been made and what the new structure will look like. Meanwhile, we continue to get emails like this from one of the groups in East Anglia who've already lost their regional manager.
She was instrumental in helping to set up our group with our first monthly meeting in 2022, which, with her dedicated support, immediately began to thrive to a current membership of over 30. This has helped to change people's lives, including my own, as my eyesight deteriorates. Help also means hope for the future, as one is made aware of and benefits from the invaluable personal and peer support now available. The regional managers made this possible.
And in a previous programme, I asked that regional manager, Sue Drew, why she was so convinced that a more centralised approach to support and advice couldn't work just as successfully and efficiently.
Because there will be no face-to-face, there will be, my understanding, is a digital, lots of offline contact, and I don't think you can reach people by a phone call, sending them a leaflet, as much as they can have in a peer support environment. And if you spoke to some of our members, I'm sure they'd agree that that's the bit. So we can go to the hospital, we can have the medical stuff. It's all important. And we, even as regional managers, or some of us do live with sight loss, we're not living their journey. We don't have that lived experience, but they all do. And what they get from each other is stronger, I believe, than anything they get. And I'm not denigrating leaflets, literature and everything else. The Macular Society has the most amazing helpline, counselling service, which is a rare thing, a counselling service these days. It's amazing. But people have to get to it. They have to find it. Very often that comes through us and the groups and the face-to-face contact.
Well, a few days ago, the staff at the Macular Society were given more details about what the future shape of the service will be and how, after extended consultation, it'll differ from what happened in the past. Well, I'm joined by the Society's CEO, Ed Holloway. Ed, that's obviously our first question. After so much upheaval and debate, what will be the key changes in how you want to deliver the service in the future?
Thank you, Peter. So last week we shared the outcome of the consultation process with our staff and also with our volunteers. And that included explaining how we responded to their feedback and the structure we'll now be implementing. One thing I'd like to say at the outset is we really do understand the vital role our local groups play in bringing people together affected by macular disease. In that interview earlier, my colleague talked about that value of face-to-face support, and I completely recognise that. We really are committed to continuing our model of local groups and ensuring that they have the support that they need to fulfil their roles. However, our model for volunteer support will be changing, and under our new structure, we'll still have a significant team dedicated to supporting our volunteers and groups with 15 staff in future. That new structure will have a reduced regional presence, but will also have new roles focusing on issues like volunteer communications and recruitment. And we're confident this new approach will continue to give volunteers the support they need.
But that lessening of regional support, won't that mean less face-to-face contact between managers, volunteers and members, and less local knowledge and contacts, which is often vital, of course.
It will in some cases lead to less face-to-face contact between our staff and our volunteers, but it won't lead to less face-to-face contact for our members, who will continue to come together to meet, to share their experiences of living with macular disease.
I mean, I still don't quite understand how you can say that if you're lessening the regional support, there'll be as much contact. That does seem to be irreconcilable, really. I mean, and I'm talking about the local knowledge that these people had, but with their regional health authorities, with ECLOs, with all those sort of people, as well as that face-to-face contact with people who are losing their sight.
So as I was saying, I do accept there will be less face-to-face contact between our staff and our volunteers, but I think it's important to recognise much of what we spoke about, my colleagues spoke about, was that real value in bringing people together with macular disease face-to-face to provide information support, work that's led by our volunteers for our local groups, and that work will absolutely continue, albeit with a different staff structure involved in supporting it.
Will this mean more redundancies?
So it does mean a reduced size of our team. And now we've decided on our new structure, we're beginning the process of implementation. Of course, that does mean talking to individual staff members about the implications for them and appointing people to new roles. And sadly, that does mean that some of our team have now been told they're at risk of redundancy.
So does that still mean there'll be, you know, some ill feeling in the organisation? And that's putting it fairly mildly, isn't it?
I think change is always difficult in organisations, particularly when you're having to reduce the size of your workforce. And it's not something we'd ever want to do as an organisation. It's not something any charity would like to do. And our focus is on supporting those staff members who are affected by the changes, appointing people to new roles and handling that redundancy process in a sensitive way as we possibly can. This is the most significant organisational change underway at the moment, and we don't have anything else like this planned, but as an organisation, of course, we'll always need to respond to events and make sure we're meeting the needs of people with macular disease and, you know, working within our organisational resources. So there are no other changes of this nature planned, but I absolutely want to make sure that we grow our reach and our impact as an organisation. And what I'd like to see us to do is add additional services and enable us to support more people living with macular disease.
Ed, how concerned are you about the effect on the organisation's reputation, you know, as a result of the controversy that this, I can only call it upheaval, really, has caused? I mean, you know, for example, that the application to the High Court for that injunction against using information from a private app, that's still floating about, being resubmitted along with a great deal of evidence, not the actions of people who've gone away and given up protesting.
So I am saddened that some of our colleagues have chosen to air their employment disputes in public. And it wouldn't be appropriate to comment on specific circumstances or pass comment in relation to any individuals. But I'm confident that we follow processes which are consistent with legal obligations and best practice, and that we've sought and we've followed appropriate expert advice. And we will, of course, respond to any legal challenges if and when they're brought.
You say if and when. Are you doubting that they will be brought?
I'm not going to comment any further other than to say we will respond to any challenges if and when they occur.
People are still confused about why this had to happen, you know, what the reasons were, if not a need to save money, which you told us in our last interview, it wasn't that. So why did it have to happen?
Part of these changes are about reducing expenditure. So as an organisation, like all charities, we need to live within our resources. And sadly, that does mean we need to reduce our cost base and therefore the size of our workforce. But these changes are also about ensuring that our structure meets the needs of our volunteers and people living with macular disease now and in the future. And that's why within this new structure, we've included dedicated roles to focus on issues like volunteer communications and volunteer recruitment, because they're really important areas for volunteers which weren't properly resourced in our previous structure.
One of the things people worried about was that the groups would find it more difficult to function without the expert help of the regional managers because, you know, a lot of the members are dealing with this new situation. Not easy to arrange all the things that they arrange. Who's going to do that now?
So I say, within our new structure, we'll have a team of 15 staff dedicated to support our local groups. And whilst a bit less of that contact will be face-to-face than it was in the past, we will absolutely be there to support volunteers with their needs. So these changes aren't about the services we provide directly to people living with macular disease. They're about the staff team who support our volunteers, who in turn lead our local groups. And our local groups are just one of the many valuable services we provide to people living with macular disease. And as we implement this new structure, I'm really confident we'll be able to provide excellent support to our volunteers, which in turn will enable our groups to continue to bring people together in their local communities.
Ed Holloway, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, I promised you some good news on the macular disease front, and here it is, although with our usual health warning on In Touch about over-optimism. But Moorfields Eye Hospital has been involved in an international trial which is offering the potentially exciting possibility of enabling people with a form of dry age-related macular degeneration to read again, albeit slowly. The BBC's medical editor, Fergus Walsh, has been finding out more about this and meeting one very satisfied patient, Sheila Irwin.
I could have cried when I looked, because I haven't seen letters for so long, and then I lit up the word. It was overwhelming. It's like relearning. It's beautiful.
Fergus, first of all, tell me a bit more about this development generally, which you've actually seen in action.
I have. And Peter, I've been reporting on this kind of implant technology for over a decade now. I remember back in 2014 being up in Manchester, where it was another very happy patient who had dry AMD. And he, for the first time in years, was able to see the shape of a door frame. Fast forward a decade and a different type of implant from a different company, and the technology is now we can have people reading again. And Sheila, as you heard, she's absolutely thrilled with it. It is a slow process. There were 32 patients who were followed up over a year in five European countries, and 27 of them were able to read again using their central vision. And of course, with dry AMD, it is that central vision, the cells in the macula, which start to go.
It's something you've got to accept. And it's hard, because I had so many people come up to me and say, oh, you can't see. I can't think of anything worse. And I think, I'm trying to cope with it myself. And you're saying to me, I can't think of anything worse. I didn't feel very good at first. And people say it still to me now, and it doesn't affect me, because I'm in this and I'm getting joy out of it, as well as helping others. Yeah, it's made such a difference.
She's completely thrilled by it and has been working really hard on making it work.
When I signed up, I must admit, I thought the microchip did most of the work, but I'm up for it and I'm enjoying it, being part of the team. Everybody's so kind. It's better than sitting on a settee thinking, oh, I can't see anything. You know, I'm getting out there, and you've got to be a mover and a shaker for things to happen.
We should stress this is very much about reading text. It's not like you could see objects more clearly.
Yes, she has this very tiny video camera on her glasses, which match what she would be seeing if she was looking straight at something. And she's looking at text, and it's kind of one word at a time. And she has to keep her head very, very still. That is sent by infrared to the chip at the back of the retina. It's then sent to this small processor, which is enhanced and then fed back in real time to the chip through the optic nerve to the brain. And Sheila and the others had to learn how to interpret those signals. She can't walk around and use this bit of kit. She has to be sitting very quietly.
I rushed my chores at home so I can get to the camera. I'll read the post, read books, do crosswords, Sudoku.
Why don't you wear it all the time?
Because I got two sets of stairs in my cottage, and I always have bare feet going down, and I don't want to lose that sense of knowing where things are in that sense.
A lot of work for the patient, really, here.
Months and months of training in how to interpret the signals coming from the chip, coming from the processor. So it's not simply switch it on and you're starting to read War and Peace again. Sheila is really the standout. I mean, she's an extraordinary lady. Her joy at being able to use this was infectious for the team at Moorfields.
Technology in medicine is moving so fast, and it's amazing. I'm part of it.
And so for the future, you will keep working with the Moorfields team?
Oh my gosh, they'll have to kick me out, honestly.
And witnessing that, her complete delight at getting this ability back that she thought she'd lost forever. She said she cried when she lost her driving licence, and she was very down when she couldn't read again. And it's an aspect of her life which has opened up again.
I mean, is there a medical process here? What has to happen to you before you can make use of this? Where does the chip go, for example?
So the chip, which is about 2 millimetres square and as thin as a human hair, that is implanted at the back of the retina, so that requires surgery. The glasses are bespoke, linked to that. The patients have to come into hospital to kind of start learning how to use it. And it's a few hours a day. It's real dedication here. This is not a simple bit of kit that you can just clip on to your specs at home. There's a lot of work here.
You've got to put the work in. You can't be faint-hearted. You've got to want it. I thought it might be a bit cumbersome at first because it's felt a bit weighty and all that. But now it's part of me. Yeah, I just put them on and away I go because I'm just looking for what I can read.
Sheila's actually been helping with the design. They're getting her some new, more ergonomic glasses for her. I think the video processor is going to get smaller. So the tech will get better.
Behind the scenes, they are building and learning and improving. So I love these people who are working so hard for, you know, there's millions of people out there. We need these people. The ultimate would be facial recognition. And one day, whether it be in my lifetime, I don't know, but they're working on it so hard and so fast. So I'm just going day to day. And this is my love, it's reading and doing it.
So at the moment, you can't tell that I'm an extremely handsome person.
Oh, I knew that. Do you know, I've heard that line so many times. I believe that you are.
But we shouldn't overpromise with this. It's not yet licensed. It will no doubt be expensive and no guarantee that the NHS will decide its value for money.
What are we actually talking about in terms of the number of people this could help and indeed when they can expect to be able to try this? Because this is still at a very experimental stage, isn't it?
It is. So very rough numbers, Peter. More than 250,000 people in the UK have geographic atrophy, the advanced form of dry AMD. So this device could help them, but it's only ever going to help a small proportion. At this stage, if it does get a license and get approved by the NHS, so a lot of ifs there, we're talking several years. The interesting thing, though, is the technology is improving all the time. So perhaps we may see a more portable device with a wider field of view in years to come. This has reached a sort of tipping point now that we have something which is giving a form of vision restoration in terms of reading ability, which is potentially really useful to patients. Although in the New England Journal of Medicine, it said it was of limited use to the patients. But talking to Sheila, who, as I say, was the star of this trial, well, she really finds it useful and she loves doing her Sudoku. She loves opening a post and she loves reading books again.
Fergus Walsh, thank you very much indeed.
There we go, Sheila.
Thank you.
I'm going to turn off the lights now.
Thank you.
Yep.
NH.
Very yes. Impressive. Very yes. Good.
That's it for today. But as usual, we want your reactions and comments on anything you've heard. You can email in touch at bbc.co.uk or leave voice messages on 0161 836 1338. From me, Peter White, and this week's producer, Fern Lullum.